and welcome to Earth Heart Network Radio, the land-to-mouth food farm and garden edition that comes to you live every week here at 1 p.m., where we remember that we're one at one. It's sort of an embedded metaphor that we do for the show, that we're one with each other in the spirit of love with the soil, the earth, the food we eat, and the world around us. And everything is alive, awake, and communicating is what I find more and more. And there are so many wonderful things we can be doing every day. And waking up to those empowered choices is what we're looking to inspire, as well as living our passion and purpose and serving our communities and doing lots of great things as part of that. Well, a happy Tuesday to you. It is definitely a rainy one and unseasonably warm weather. We went from a blizzard to now we're going to be up in the 60s, close to 70 degrees in early February, you know, sort of like spring plopped right in the middle of winter there, and still a lot of snow all over the mountains. But much of it melted around Asheville and some of the warmer areas. But up in those shady mountain valleys, you get some real snowfall and it just stays there. And it's still there. But otherwise, it is the midpoint called Imbolc. It is just moving towards spring now. We are calling it Groundhog Day. These days we hear the groundhog did in fact not see his shadow. So that was an early prediction for spring. So it's great to really look at the deeper meaning, though, of these sort of farmer holidays, the cross-quarter points of the year that relate to planting times and the coming of the sun and the leaving of the sun and lengthening of days and how we navigate that in harmony with the garden. So great to pass that little point in the year, tipping towards spring, and of course all the great events that'll be happening at Living Web Farms and other events around our area, like Organic Growers School, and lots of spring happenings. Of course, we have many farms out there that make things available at farmers markets that we can be supporting again when they open back up in the spring. And it's exciting. You know, spring can be a great time to clean out, to maybe make those good choices for your diet, really new for cleansing, getting those fresh greens. And I'm really discovering coconut oil. And really handmade, wonderful virgin coconut oil that I've discovered. And it's changing people's lives. It's really helping people with many different conditions. And I personally am switching to that for many reasons. And it's just amazing, you know, how you feel. And I'm reading a book with all these recipes. And, you know, making a good new choice can be exciting because, you know what, you just might feel better. And that's what I'm having to do, is feel better. I've got some things going on with my body doing a shift-o-change-o on me, and I've got to adapt and say, hey, what am I doing to be out of balance, and how can I bring back the balance? And coconut oil is a wonderful healing compound that we are given by nature, and you can actually get wonderful coconut oil that is handmade the old-fashioned way. I did my homework. I was looking for the best coconut oil I could possibly find, and I came across Tropical Traditions. And they live out on a coconut farm in the Philippines. And he and his wife started to make coconut oil. They would eat this wonderful, delicious, traditionally handmade coconut oil. And it was just completely heavenly, right? And then they tried some of the other coconut oils out there that are refined and have machine processing and not this old-fashioned way that keeps the most flavor and nutrition. And so they decided, we are going to start really doing this and offering it to the world. And they started bringing back the traditional way of doing the coconut oil by separating it out by hand and letting it naturally separate overnight instead of using heavy machinery. Tons of things in this nutritional profile of coconut oil. It's just absolutely a wonderful oil for us and our body. And so I just want to let you know about that as one possible thing to look at for the new year. And turmeric. I've talked to you about turmeric before, and now we've got some new information about what happens to your body if you eat 1 teaspoon of turmeric every day. Well, turmeric has been called the most powerful herb that exists by many people, including New Chapter, who owns more organic turmeric farms in the world than anyone, and they provide many turmeric-including products in their New Chapter line that I just love. They are a high-quality company. And turmeric is so great. It's so great for us in so many ways. And they've done a study here. Now, in India, of course, turmeric has been crowned the queen of all spices for over 2,500 years. Although it was first used as a dye, over the centuries, its true healing powers have slowly come to light. The golden yellow, right? If you put turmeric on something like your cutting board, you've got a yellow cutting board, right? Bright yellow and orangey yellow. So what we're looking at is a teaspoon of turmeric a day keeps inflammation, toxins, pain, and cancers at bay. And this is more than you could almost hope for. And it really goes after the cancers in so many ways. I did a capstone project in nutrition some years ago. And, you know, when you really look at what these natural compounds do with wonderful effects and no side effects like the pharmaceutical drugs out there that are quite harmful while maybe alleviating a symptom, these true foods, these healing medicinal foods are really so powerful in every way with just more and more benefits as you eat them. And I love learning about these things and sharing, because another thing you want to include is turmeric. You could even make a little vegetable saute with coconut oil and some turmeric spice and some other Indian spices in there. And, you know, maybe cut some of the bitterness of the turmeric, mix it up with some other things and keep it really healthy. It fights inflammation naturally. And, you know, in our world, most people walk around ungrounded all the time, building up bioelectric pollution in their body and causing all kinds of health issues and aging and this inflammatory fire raging through them, basically, in the form of these positively charged ions. And when we go out and we get our feet on the ground, we get near the earth, we get grounded, then we release those and we can neutralize and get our volts back down and not have all that charge built up. But and that comes from being ungrounded and being around electronics and all the things that we do here. I mean, I sit at my desk, I look around, I've got tons of things, right? Computers and lights and microphones and phones and more lamps and other things and speakers. And, you know, we are around all these things and it affects us. So getting grounded is important for fighting inflammation naturally. That's another way, but turmeric is a powerful herb to do it. Chronic inflammation is believed to be the main culprit of many of our modern diseases. And how do we get inflammation? Well, I just mentioned a few ways. We also get it by eating a bunch of junk. If we eat a bunch of junky food, it really causes some very harmful responses in our body. And that's how making these dietary changes can be so powerful. You can truly feel better if you just tweak your diet here and there. I've made some massive changes this week and I'm walking the talk. I'm eating the food, the right stuff, and, you know, I feel better. And it was vital for me to do that. So, you know, we've got to be inspired. Sometimes you have to get a little motivated to go ahead and do that and realize how important it is before you have a health crisis, you know, or get through that somehow as quick as you can if you get in one, which I did a little bit, and, you know, immediately make good choices. And I immediately retooled some things in my diet, and I'm doing it, and everything starts to change, right? Everything changes when we do these things. So a teaspoon of turmeric a day can protect your brain as well. Cognitive disorders such as dementia and Alzheimer's are often linked to decreased levels of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, okay? That's BDNF, which is a type of growth hormone. Researchers have found that curcumin in turmeric positively influences the levels of BDNF and may delay or even reverse many brain diseases or age-related decline of our brain functions. Now, when you pair that, right, with our new knowledge about how important the microbiome is for brain health, then you want to have the most biodiverse and balanced gut and flora in your system that you support through healthy organic food and soil and really healthy choices and great clean water and getting grounded and all of that, then we really can match it up with these things like turmeric. We can work together all these things in harmony and really have a healing diet. So turmeric also, as we mentioned, reduces several types of cancer. It's one of the most potent natural anti-cancer substances out there. Not only can it prevent cancer growth, but it inhibits the development and spread as well and may even hold the natural cure for this dreadful disease. Now, honestly, it's not, nothing is a magic button, right? But people that eat turmeric all the time, right? Every day, Northern India, there's an area. They have less than 2% of Alzheimer's there. They have almost unknown to have Alzheimer's, okay? And here we're having epidemic rates of it. Then you have they don't have all the cancers, you know, and you just got to look at having that diet rounded out and balancing it. And we've got some other great tools that we're looking into balance today. It's feeling like a tipping point toward health and toward being more in tune with our food. And that's a big part of what the Land to Mouth Food Farm and Garden Connection of Earth Heart Network Radio is. Touching base with really powerful agricultural models, techniques, people, cutting-edge teachers and information. And also, how do we balance our own diet, our own choices, and have a great quality of life so we can live our passion and build a sustainable culture right now, every day, every single choice. And it's empowering to not only make great dietary choices yourself, but then to inspire others through action. And, you know, ultimately, we lead by example. So whenever we make these great choices, then we are also inspiring others to perhaps think of doing the same or something similar to that might help them. Turmeric can also improve digestion. It stimulates the gallbladder, reducing bloating and gas, and prevents inflammation of the digestive tract. So if people are already suffering from a gallbladder disease, though, people aren't really recommended to take it because it might overstimulate it, you know, not being good in that case if they already have a gallbladder disease. But in beforehand, maybe, before you end up with a gallbladder problem, or we, you know, keep those healthy herbs in our diet, we don't end up with the problem. It also protects the heart. Curcumin has shown to reduce LDL or bad cholesterol, preventing blood clotting in the heart and removing plaque buildups in the arteries. And this is realpharmacy.com giving us all this great information as a reminder. Just one teaspoon of turmeric a day in a dish or in a something. You know, you could put it in a butter, make turmeric, I mean, coconut oil, turmeric butter, right? With garlic or something. I mean, there's so many ways to integrate these things. So turmeric also delays aging, improves longevity, and there are so many things that can happen. Now, here's an interesting thing to remember. Turmeric is fantastic. This is the tip of the iceberg of what it can do for us. It's such a healthy herb. It's wonderful, right? And its most active healing compound, curcumin, is not necessarily absorbed by our body that well. So what you can do is combine it and have a little synergy, right? So you can up your absorption of curcumin by up to 2,000% by just adding a pinch of black pepper to it. And you know, people make a turmeric milk and they put black pepper and like maybe a coconut milk or an almond milk or a cashew milk or something like that, and the turmeric in there and a few other things, whatever you want to do, and they make a delicious turmeric milk that combines those ingredients. You can drink it daily, and you will be zooming through those free radicals. You will be healing inflammation in your body and helping yourself feel better. So pinch black pepper with turmeric in that nice turmeric tea, delicious, really soothing and healing thing you can maybe figure out a way to integrate that, and it'll help you out. So have fun with these new things, coconut oil, turmeric, getting your body in balance. And one of the things that we can forget about, and I knew about it, and then I forgot about it again, but then I still knew about it, and then I remembered, and then someone that I know posted something about that, right? And what it is the Chinese medicine body clock of energy and how the body organs function and what they do at what times of day, right? So, for example, 1 to 3 a.m. is the liver's time to detoxify. So if you eat really late and overload your liver and your stomach and your whole body for digestion, then you can't properly digest or detoxify, and then you wake up in the night with an overwhelmed liver. And so it's good to keep in balance by looking at that clock. And it's the Chinese energy clock of the day, and it goes around, you know, things like eating at noon, digestion, being, you know, waking up, the whole way your body is functioning and staying in balance with that. That is another wonderful thing to do, and it is easily just, it sort of helps schedule the day a little bit, because then you're like, okay, you know, it's 9 o'clock, okay, I didn't eat dinner, but maybe I don't have a whole dinner, maybe I'm just going to go ahead and drink this tea and have a little snack that's something wholesome, but whatever. Making those choices to help support that little trip your body makes around the clock every day and what's doing what at what time, like when your liver is cleansing, when your kidneys are working, when is your time for digestion, you know, all these things to keep in mind help us keep that balance as well. As we move through this new year, we want to feel great, have the energy to live the life of our dreams every day and do our best, and to be in connection with each other, to wake up to the fantastic awareness of social networks that are in real life, already out there. Trees are the original social networks of the soil. They are like the internet hub stations that connect all the other organisms in a forest. And we have a brand new story from a German forest ranger finds that trees have social networks in his forest. He's come quite aware of it in Hummel, Germany. In the deep stillness of a forest in winter, the sound of footsteps on a carpet of leaves moves along there. Peter Wolheben has found what he was looking for, a pair of towering beech trees. He said, "These trees are friends," craning his neck to look up at the leafless crowns black against the gray sky. He talks about how the pairs are interconnected at the roots. When one tree dies, the other dies too. He's a forest ranger, and he is looking after these trees, and he started seeing that he's got his own scientific observations now of these very, you know, interesting terms that are quite anthropomorphic. It's long known to biologists, though, that trees in the forest are social beings. They can count, learn, and remember. They can nurse sick neighbors by providing nutrients in the soil. They can warn each other of danger by sending electrical signals across that fungal network known as the wood wide web. The wood wide web. I've never heard that. That's so cute. And for reasons unknown, they keep the ancient stumps of long-felled companions alive for centuries by feeding them a sugar solution through their roots. They are feeding their elders, the trees. I didn't even realize that. You know, I read these things and I find out things, and then I find out more and I learn more. And great information here in the New York Times. And thank you, Sally McGrain, for bringing this to us in the Saturday Profile. You know, they're even feeding the elders, the old trees. You know, I feel the sadness of the loss of the great old trees. I feel like there's way too much furniture and things and stuff that's already been burned down or whatever out there, chopped down our forest too much already. And it's time that we really protect what's left and replant what we can and revitalize our ecosystems. And if we can learn to hear the message of the trees, that would be a great thing, you know, because they are communicating. They're keeping the ancient stumps of the long-felled companions of the forest alive for centuries by feeding them through their roots. So this gentleman, this forester, is looking along here, and they've got a new book at The Way He Looks at the Forest, and talking about being amazed by Mr. Wolheben's ability to capture the public's attention, really talking, communicating with the trees in the forest more than talking about them. There's also the popularity of The Hidden Life of Trees. That is another book there. And really great to see how the acknowledgement of the communities in the forest is coming to light and looking at forestry in a new way as communities out there, communities of trees, fungal networks, highly communicative, really talking back and forth, and extremely high rates of communication going on, and to really honor that before we ever set foot in a forest with a machine to destroy that vital part of our ecosystem. So just a reminder there of just how alive and social the trees are and what's going on so much more than what we might be tuning into and hearing. Just briefly going over the human body energy clock. Again, I pulled that up. The Comfy Tummy. Yes, comfytummy.com. You can find this there. Yeah, C-O-M-F-Y, tummy, comfytummy.com. You can find the human body energy clock. And it's really nice to take a look at this and just kind of keep your day mapped out. You know, print it out. I printed one out the other day. Print it out and just be aware of what you're doing in the day and help keep your body in balance, right? So say you start out, you get up at 7 a.m., eat breakfast, you know, something nice, a little protein, healthy fats, take some nice, you know, nice clean water. Maybe have an alkalizing shot of lemon juice, honey water with that delicious cayenne in there. Pack some lunch and snacks. And then we hit our, that's a stomach time. Then we hit our spleen time at 9 a.m. Work and be active. Be active with mental powers, supporting metabolism and converting nutrients into energy. Then we hit 11 a.m. Heart time, getting into 11 to 1. Eating, enjoying conversations, connecting with people, cooperation, reaching out, being of service. Lunch, a nutritious, balanced lunch as we move from 11 to 1 there in that digestive hour, hour 2. And then we move into small intestines from 1 to 3, solving and getting organized, sorting out issues. The body is digesting lunch and you're sorting. It's in the sorting mode right there from 1 to 3 p.m. And then 3 to 5, the bladder, work, study, and drink tea. Yes, best time for efficient work and to have your afternoon tea. Drink tea, more water, and detox. And keep that liquid flowing. We are chronically dehydrated, right? We've got to drink more water. Speaking of tea, I have a beautiful tea here. It might be cool enough for me to have a sip. Let's try it. Oh, wonderful. Herbal tea. Throat coat. That's what the tea I just poured there, along with a tea ball of a bunch of herbs that I'm working with right now, and a little bit of stevia. No glycemic index there at all. Just nice, perfectly tasting, wonderful detoxing tea. Just wonderful to have here in these afternoon hours. And that tea time really is 3 to 5, but you know, I've got to have my tea for the show. It's just nice. So at 5 o'clock, we're hitting the kidney hour there till 7 p.m. Eat dinner, restore your energy. Yes, your kidney, store your energy and your reserves. If you feel tired, what did you spend your energy on? You've got to sometimes restore and rebuild that. 5 to 7, eat a nice dinner, not too heavy, right? Then we get from 7 to 9, we're looking at the pericardium. And that pericardium is responsible for circulation, brain and reproductive organs. And this is actually the time to socialize, flirt, have fun. It's actually the best time to conceive, actually, a child, or get a massage. Pericardium time from 7 to 9. Then from 9 to 11, we've got the triple warmer. Yes, thyroid and adrenals responsible for energy transfer, temperature and metabolism. Avoid eating. So don't be having those 10 o'clock dinners. I'm terrible at doing that sometimes. Just putting off dinner too long, and then it's late, and I'm over there eating when I shouldn't be eating. So we've got to, I've got to remember to do that early, do the eating time over there, you know, and 5 to 7, right? Around 6 maybe, cook from 5 to 6 and 6 to 7, something like that. Have the dinner at the dinner time. Then you can support the lightness of being necessary for the thyroid and adrenals to do what they need to do with your metabolism. Relax, maybe read, catch up on some reading. Then from 11 to 1, we move into gallbladder. Time to sleep and regenerate. And if people have gallstones, they might have pain at this time. If you have an issue with an organ, you might have pain during that time of day that relates to that organ. So when we look at our farm and garden and food connection, and we look at being in touch with our day and looking at how we're eating, it's important to consider these things. We can be supporting our gallbladder, our liver. Liver time comes next, 1 to 3. If you're waking up at that time, your liver is overwhelmed by the detoxing process. And that's what was happening to me because I was eating dinner too late. I was eating dinner too late, and I was waking up every night like that at that time, you see? And there's these obvious things we're doing. And it's just so powerful to tweak that little choice of dinner time, making sure when you are digested well enough to be having a good sleep, keeping it in balance. Then from 3 a.m. to 5 a.m., lungs, yes, sleep soundly. If you cough at this time, your lungs are expelling toxins. The lungs, every part of our body has this time where it's working on cleaning itself and exchanging energy with other parts of the body to stay in balance. Then we move it from 5 to 7 a.m., large intestine, wake up and drink water. Go for a brisk walk. No caffeine at this hour. Your body needs water for a healthy colon. That's 5 to 7 a.m. So 5 to 7 a.m. is sort of like nice time. Have a meditation, maybe write in a journal, dream journal perhaps, or, you know, and drink the good water and get the body going, take a nice walk. It sounds great. And then you move into that breakfast again at stomach from 7 to 9. That's just the human energy, human body energy clock telling you about that so you can really just take a sense of how to support your body's natural cycles. It's really helpful. And thank you, ComfyTummy.com. It's one of the cutest website names I've ever heard, right? ComfyTummy.com. I would recommend going there and checking out comfytummy.com. It's very nice. Well, there's some not-so-comfy stuff going on, of course, as well as all the great things that we can do and our great choices that help us be empowered and feel wonderful and be healthy, help us have the energy to take on all those other things that need to be done that aren't as, you know, that are just needing to be done, right? And one of those things is the genetically engineered trees that are now being approved. We have a breaking news story that just came out a few days ago. Thank you to StopGETrees.org for the International Campaign to Stop Genetically Engineered Trees, Dogwood Alliance, and Biofuel Watch. These are forest organizations that are experts. Groups condemn the U.S. for bowing to industry, ignoring widespread public opposition. Yes, groups from around the world joined together just a few days ago to announce the U.S. denounce the U.S. government for allowing the first genetically engineered tree, a loblolly pine, to be legalized with no government or public oversight, with no assessment of their risk to the public or the environment, and without regard to overwhelming public opposition. Now, I first learned more about GE trees, genetically engineered trees, from Dr. Richard McDonald. I recommend you seeing his Dr. McBug video on Living Web Farms. He is fantastic talent. And he was talking about the danger of these trees because the pollen mixes with other trees, contaminates them, and disturbs the entomological biodiversity and the health of the population of insects. And that's his specialty. He is an entomologist. And so there are many concerns about these trees. And to think that there is no oversight and we're already getting sort of a hush-hush approval, well, that's just not making sense here. We don't need this kind of decision-making. We've got to make safe decisions for a long-term sustainable future. But in a secret letter from the USDA to a GE tree company, ArborGen, dated last August, it was recently exposed by scientist Doug Gurian-Sherman of the Center for Food Safety. This letter, the USDA made the unprecedented decision to allow ArborGen to pursue unregulated commercial cultivation of a loblolly pine genetically engineered for altered wood composition. These trees could be planted anywhere in the United States without public knowledge or access to information about them. That's just not cool. That's just not a good idea, because then we don't know where this contamination is going on, and then we cannot properly study what goes on. And so this is just really not very acceptable. Gurian-Sherman argues the USDA is deliberately thumbing its nose at the public with this decision. He says, pointing out that this probably is the biggest environmental regulatory change in the United States since the early 1990s. Loblolly pines are native across 14 states throughout the U.S. Southeast and are grown in plantations around the world. Their pollen is known to travel for hundreds of miles. Hundreds of miles. So anywhere that these are, and they could be in tons of places, hundreds of miles are contaminated. So think about that. And we aren't even going to test them or have oversight or even know where they are. It more than makes you wonder. It just makes you shake your head, right? The SMH thing, that's what it means. I finally found out, shaking my head, right? I think there's a lot of SMH you hear in this show sometimes because I shake my head a lot. Unbelievable to me, some of the stuff that goes on. But it is going on. And that's why I talk about it, because we've got to be informed to make great choices. We've got to be informed so that we can help each other be aware. We've got to know what's going on. And that's why this is so acceptable to not know so much about these loblolly pines and yet to get approval. So Dr. Rachel Smolker of Biofuel Watch, biologist there, said if these GE loblolly pines are released on a large scale in the United States, there will be no way to stop them from cross-contaminating native loblolly pines. This is deliberate, irreversible, and completely irresponsible contamination of the environment with unknown and possibly devastating consequences. Forest ecosystems are barely understood, and the introduction of trees with genes modified for wood characteristics could have all manner of negative impacts on soils, fungi, insects, wildlife, songbirds, and public health. And all this for short-term commercial profit. You know, sometimes you just have to snap out of it and realize it's not worth selling everything off for a little pile of money. It's just not. The earth is worth more than that. Our dignity is worth more than that. As earth stewards, it's our job to take care of this planet, not to devastate it. So things like this just are not, they're not healthy for the environment. They're not healthy for the greater good. Many are also worried about the international implications of this USDA decision. Winnie Overbeek, international coordinator of the Uruguay-based World Rainforest Movement, states, "We are greatly concerned that these unregulated GE pines could be shipped to Brazil or other countries without public or even government knowledge, further promoting the expansion of industrial tree plantations in the global south, where those are the lungs of our planet, our forests we need to protect instead of replace them for a little pile of money." We cannot breathe money, right? Nobody can breathe that. Not even the richest person in the world can breathe that. So we've got to be able to have a planet that is livable and sustainable. So this idea of contaminating other ecosystems with these GE trees contributes to deforestation and affects indigenous and peasant communities worldwide who depend on forests for survival. And they don't depend on genetically engineered pine trees. In 2013, when the USDA called for public comments on another ArborGen request to commercialize a GE eucalyptus tree, and that decision is still pending. I mean, eucalyptus trees are extremely invasive. They're already extremely invasive. So then they want to put a genetically engineered eucalyptus tree that could be really invasive and not know what it's really going to do. They received comments at the rate of 10,000 to 1 opposing the industry request. By simply refusing to regulate this new GE pine, the USDA has cut the public out of the process completely. This can't be okay, right? We've got to have, we're supposed to have laws for this kind of thing, right? And that's why the campaign to stop GE trees is an international alliance getting out there to protect the forest, because we need to be doing this. Because otherwise it's like, swoop, there went that. And we've got to know what's going on. We can't just have the public completely cut out of the process when it comes to a commercial interest that's short-sighted and disastrous for the whole ecosystem. In 2013, a conference on tree biotechnology in Asheville, right here in Asheville, was disrupted for its entire 5 days by anti-GE tree activists, and there were multiple arrests, apparently. People are very passionate about this. They're trying to get the word out. You can find out more at stopgetrees.org. There's more information there. They're talking about things like indigenous people in the forest taking action, learning more about the campaign. You can do it there. But we've got to keep an eye on these things and do our best to step up as needed, because otherwise they're just swooping by and we lose that opportunity to have done something, to have just tilted it a little more toward the positive. And that's what we do with every single choice, right? We can tilt it just a little more in the direction of life, in the direction of biodiversity, in the direction of honoring all life in the spirit of love and respect. Even from our little brothers and sisters and other species that are out there that are far, far away, like orcas. Orcas have had a really hard time lately. They've been hit hard by radiation. They have lost critical habitat. They have gone through a lot. We had almost 100% orca infant mortality rate over this last year. And thank you to us.whales.org giving us this story about critical habitat. When an area is designated as critical habitat, what does that mean? And how does it help the whales and dolphins? We've got to be doing more of that, because we've got agencies responsible for protecting whales and dolphins, and meanwhile, rules are being pushed aside for risky tests that are going to destroy them and their critical habitats. We've got to designate critical habitat for the wild creatures that remain. We really are so close to just completely losing so much of the amazing creatures out there, and I feel the loss. To me, it's like the great sadness of the destruction of nature. And We've got to do something about it. You know, we've got to really protect it. Critical habitat protects the home of the species, not the species itself. Critical habitat includes the current range of species, but it can also include the historic range and others outside of that range. And so the southern resident orcas, also known as southern resident killer whales, need their critical habitat protected. And you can actually do that. If you'd like to join up with that, us.whales.org. Sign the petition asking for increased critical habitat. They need it. It's all up and down from San Francisco, Point Reyes, all the way up to Vancouver. This is critical habitat, and it needs to be expanded for the southern resident orcas. We can act now to urge the Fisheries Service to move forward and save this intelligent social species. It's in danger of disappearing. Many of the whales and dolphins and that whole area of the country are suffering from much of the radiation that has been spewed out into the ocean. And we've got to protect and do what we can and see if they'll have a chance of surviving. So I encourage you to check that out. You know, just follow your passion and your heart and what's meaningful. What's meaningful to you that gets you excited and happy to think about helping to make a difference on? What gets you going? What gets you fired up and happy to share with others and lifts you up when you do it? And, you know, take action on that. Take even a small thing. Find some interest, some way to engage your interest on that. And do even a little thing, and it will lift you up. And one of the things that you can do, which is kind of fun, that I'm about to do here. Thank you, Robert Redford, for leading the way on this one. He says, let's call on President Obama to end all new oil and gas leasing on public lands. And this is a message that is going to go out. And a thank you, a big thank you to President Obama for halting coal mining on public lands and asking him to ban oil and gas as well. You know, there are sacred sites with ancient sacred sites like Chaco Canyon, I just heard, that have like 300 and something fracking leases pending. And we already know in places like Oklahoma that hundreds of earthquakes have been caused because of fracking. It has been figured out. It's not a mystery. People are having massive property damage. Their water supplies are wrecked. And it's really awful that we've got these gas leases being potentially opened up on beautiful places, oil and gas that would destroy these wonderful public lands. They're not there to have somebody destroy it for everybody else. It's public to be shared in stewardship to take care of it. And it's really great because we have a big thank you for halting the coal mining, but it's time to ban the oil and gas leases as well. Because to think of places like New Mexico's Chaco Canyon being wrecked by fracking is just heartbreaking. We've got to have a breakthrough move that will protect our climate and millions of acres of public lands from not only the ravages of coal mining, but also of oil and gas, because we cannot also be burning our environment up either. It's not just a matter of saving the public lands. It's also we cannot afford to burn up our atmosphere by burning these fuels. So let's protect New Mexico's Chaco Canyon, Utah's Desolation Canyon, and many other natural treasures vulnerable to the dangers of fracking and other oil and gas development. We'll be thanking the president for his continued leadership on climate and ask him to accelerate our move to a clean energy by expanding this moratorium to all fossil fuels on public lands. If you'd like to get in on this one, let your voice be heard. Natural Resources Defense Council, yes, NRDC online. Go there and check out all the ways that you can get involved and let your voice be heard. Earth Heart Network Radio, the Land to Mouth Food Farm and Garden Connection that comes your way here every Tuesday. Glad to be here with you and encouraging better choices, little choices that make a big difference over time. Things like eating coconut oil or turmeric or drinking tea in the afternoon, being in tune with your body. We talked about that earlier in the show, and I encourage you to do whatever it is that your inner voice is telling you will help you bring balance. There's great lists out there of ways to bring balance. There's the human energy body clock we talked about from Chinese medicine. And there's natural herbs and foods, of course. And just think of this healing time as we move towards spring, but yet not quite, of lightening our load so that we can really cleanse and be uplifted when spring does arrive. Looking more into Southern Forests, thank you always, Dogwood Alliance, standing for our forests, our strength. This question is being posed here just out the other day at dogwoodalliance.org by Adam Macon. Could EU biomass investigation signal relief for our southern forests? I've talked to you about this before, how they've been chopping down the forests here in the southeast of the United States and then burning it and chipping it as biofuel to be used in Europe and acting like that's some kind of a great choice. That is not a good choice, and it's definitely not great to be chopping down our forests. We've got to be, as I always say, protecting and preserving them and finding alternative materials, things that we have used logs for traditionally. Well, now the not-so-great and conscious process of biomass and the destruction of our southern forests is coming to light as the EU Commission recently announced an investigation into the state aid provided for the world's largest forest destroyer for electricity, Drax. I mean, doesn't that just sound like that? Like, I mean, it sounds, it just does. Anyway, it reminds me of Fern Gully, right? When the Hexus, right? Hexus was the spirit, the whole thing. They were trying to destroy the forest, right? Drax. So we've got the biggest forest destroyer is called Drax. The taxpayer dollars that the UK is providing Drax to convert to burning southern U.S. forests for electricity is a big reason why this destructive industry is moving us backwards away from a healthy, truly sustainable future. So, you know, we need to stop that. Since industrial biomass exploded onto the scene in the southern United States, the industry has attempted to paint itself as one that fits into the framework and culture of the traditional logging industry. They want the public to see a symbiotic relationship with an already existing country, to believe that our precious resources are simply being managed efficiently and no impacts will be felt by the forest communities or even the timber markets. Well, the image of a mutually beneficial relationship between biomass and the traditional logging industry is a complete illusion. And this, according to DogwoodAlliance.org, competition with the existing forest products industry. This goes on at a public event. It was heard hearing from the paper industry saying the biomass industry is not taking our waste or residues. What they're taking is our product. We don't produce waste. So what we've looked at is that we're supposed to think that wood pellets solely consist of waste and residues. The pressure on our precious forest has increased because it's not. They're actually logging for it. Why would our traditional wood products industries like the paper industries be so upset about wood pellets? Well, due to the false classification of biomass as a carbon neutral form of energy, enormous amounts of taxpayer dollars are being directed toward the biomass industry. A recent study by RISI Commission, by the American Forest and Paper Association, found that UK wood pellet subsidies distort the U.S. market for wood fiber. According to our partners at Biofuel Watch, Drax's renewable energy subsidies in 2014 were equivalent to 79% of their gross annual profits. Well, that's gross indeed, isn't it? 79% was a straight subsidy just to go chop the forest. With conversion of a third unit, which is currently under investigation, and their coal subsidies, Drax can look forward to over $930 million a year. That's over $2.5 million a day in UK taxpayer money to cut down our forests over here and then chip it up as wood. I mean, not wood, biofuel. And it doesn't, it's not biofuel, right? It's anti-bio fuel because it's taking life away from the forest. The grossly distorted subsidies allow pellet producers to pay up to five times the market price. And this incentivizes the destruction of our forests here, right here in North Carolina, right here, right here. And they have been wanting to open up way more logging, and people are going bananas because they're going to ruin beautiful ecosystems, beautiful trails, things that are people want to come and have ecotourism, come walk in the forest and connect with nature and get out of the city and spend lots of money to come and travel and eat out and enjoy coming on vacation here. And we want to chop all that down so some logging company can ship off the trees to the UK? No way, right? That's selling out way too cheap. That's really bad. Plus, then our air quality goes down and everything goes down in quality of life here. So these funds are subsidizing an industry that takes the raw materials used by our traditional wood product industries. This makes it harder for traditional wood product industries to operate as well, driving up the cost of timber products and adding fewer jobs to the regional economy, which I'm not really supportive of everybody going out and being a logger to begin with, right? It's like, get a skill. I mean, I know it's great. It's an important skill to be able to cut a tree and not smash your house in or whatever, or not hurt someone and be able to fell a tree successfully, but not that your life and job is just, I'm going to just chop down forests. Because you know what? That to me is a destructive, unsustainable job. And, you know, it's more safe to have a skill that can actually support your family rather than just rely on destroying the forest. Because to me, that's not a good career plan. So that's why I say that. But looking at the bigger picture, the biomass industry is pumping a ton of carbon into the atmosphere. It is not a carbon neutral form of energy. It's the opposite of the intention of renewable energy subsidies. Renewable energy subsidies should be restricted to renewable energy, and this is not renewable energy. And so we've really got to look at what we're doing here, and we're subsidizing something that is not even what it's supposed to be subsidizing. So we've got to work toward the truly sustainable timber market, which to me it's quite limited, because we really need to call a sort of a moratorium on mass scale logging, in my opinion, because otherwise we have no chance to work on our climate successfully if we just continue to keep destroying the forests that stabilize the climate. So to me, it's a big cutback on things like logging and a big expansion of sustainable materials you can grow, like industrial hemp or KNEF or different things that grow much more quickly, like bamboo. You can use things that grow much faster and without destroying our old growth forests that remain, that are the cornerstones of a stable climate. And we can be adding cover crops to every piece of bare ground and stopping desertification and stopping topsoil loss and building the life in our soil. All of these things sequester carbon. And chopping down forests in wholesale should not, to me, be an option at this point. These are short-sighted corporations that are not the only stakeholders in our forests. Just because someone, a big company, can buy land doesn't mean they should be able to destroy out that whole ecosystem. A new vision must be inclusive of our local communities and our wildlife. A vision that is valuing clean air, clean water, and safe communities. Governments can no longer fund the profit over planet strategies of companies and industry associations. It's too risky. It's too risky to incentivize industrial scale biomass and just denude our forests completely. It's sad enough. They've already logged the forest here. I mean, when you're in the forest here in this area, you can see all the areas where the trees are really small and there's hardly any large trees because it was logged not that long ago. And people advertise their homes with oak timber, you know, like, oh, you can have value by chopping down the trees on the property if you buy it. And, you know, it shouldn't be that we sell out that easily, that we just chop our trees down for lumber. They're social. They're part of our community. They're here to stabilize and provide shade and keep the temperatures nice and cool and be a haven and a home for birds and wildlife, and communicating as an internet hub with all the other plant communities in a whole ecosystem and in a microclimate. Those trees communicate across hundreds of miles. They even nurse each other. And, you know, we've got to learn to value and cherish our trees and not just selling them wholesale for something that is not even what it says it is. And in the South, we've learned the hard way with Europe in the past and sustainability. And here we are again in a deal with Europe, and we're getting our forests denuded, just taken right out. The Our Forests Aren't Fuel campaign applauds the EU Commission for investigating the UK state aid given to Drax and urges them to put an end to funding this destructive industry and invest that money in real sustainable fuel. Real sustainable fuel that works for the planet, and that allows our forests to stand. You can't call something bio, which is life fuel, like, oh yeah, it's life fuel. It's the whole life of the forest chopped up into little bits, and it's not helping. So check it out more for yourself there at dogwoodalliance.org. And thank you, Dogwood team, and Adam Macon and Dana and everyone there at Dogwood Alliance for standing for our forests, our strength. Dogwoodalliance.org. Check them out. Great to be with you here today. It is February 2nd. Happy Groundhog Day. The turning of the wheel of the year in bulk as we just tip right towards spring and moving a little bit into some warmer days. We just came out of the blizzard and now we are headed toward very springy temperatures in the next few days and lots of rain. But it's always a joy to share great information and get those seeds ready for your spring garden. Get your seedlings started. A lot of people I know are starting their seedlings, many different things, and getting them ready and getting them up to size. Have your little lights all set up. You can learn more about the videos we have on that at Living Web Farms. Use the search bar and look up seed starting. There's lots of great stuff there on that. And get your little setup going. It's very exciting what we can do when we really jump ahead and do our best to get it going, even growing something small like broccoli sprouts. I've got a little bit of broccoli sprouts in there and alfalfa sprouts and some fenugreek sprouts. And, you know, those things are healing and wonderful as well. They provide digestive enzymes. So you can make that another little great healing choice is to add sprouts and fermented foods to your diet and help your digestive process move along to get more out of your food. That is a wonderful thing to always do. We get that cherished food out of our garden or something we grew or something we bought at the wonderful organic store there, a co-op or whatever, get your organic food that is an investment, right? It's an investment in your health and it's not cheap. And you get that food and the next thing you know, you aren't necessarily assimilating it well or digesting it right. Get those enzymes in there. Get those sprouts in there with every meal just before and you will be digesting even better. You know, it's interesting. We're talking about trees and how social they are. And this is just an interesting ancient social connection of trees. And this is from AmericanForests.org. American Forests, Protecting and Restoring Forests. Trees that miss the mammoths. You know, there were trees that once depended on animals like the woolly mammoth for survival. But they have managed to adapt and survive in the modern world. Thank you to Whit Brana for bringing us this story. When it still roamed the earth, the Columbian mammoth acted as a dispersal system for many tree species that still exist today. And, you know, you've got to look things in a different way. And it's a really cute little warning here. Warning, reading or learning about this information may cause a whiplash-inducing paradigm shift. You will no longer view wild areas the same way. Your concepts of pristine wilderness and the balance of nature will be forever compromised. You may even start to see ghosts. This is the warning on this Trees That Miss Mammoths article. Going back to ancient times, consider the fruit of the Osage orange, named after the Osage Indians associated with its range. In the fall, Osage orange trees hang heavy with bright green bumpy spheres the size of softballs, full of seeds and an unpalatable milky latex. They soon fall to the ground where they rot. Unused unless a child decides to test their ballistic properties are very hard. Now, I've actually heard because they don't seem to know here yet in this article that those trees, that milky substance is a highly medicinal, wonderful substance. So people are actually selling a product of that now, of that juice and medicinal product that is very healing and has certain wonderful compounds that are very healthful. And so what was thought to be this thing, like what do we do with it now? People are actually gathering them from places where people don't want them because of these big giant balls in people's yards. And they have those trees and they say, you can come get them for free. Just get them out of my yard, right? And they're gathering them and they're actually making this medicinal product with the Osage orange. But what we're talking about here is the fact that they are laying around in many places, and many of these types of fruits do so to entice animals to eat them, along with the seeds they contain. And now we don't have any more megalithic old mammoths to eat those. And so many of these species that things used to eat and spread their seeds that are very large, you see some of these big seed pods, those megafauna are gone, and they don't get to travel as much. No native animal is eating Osage orange fruits. And the same question could be said of large seed pod of the honey locust and the Kentucky coffee tree. So when we look at that and we see that, it's the trees are missing those megafauna as well, and then their ranges have changed. And so all of the trees' migrations through the old mammoth and other megafauna have completely been altered since they've been gone. And just one other aspect of the social aspect of trees from the ancient to the modern. Well, Patrick Battle is with us today for This Week in the Garden. It's much warmer. We're getting even warmer and lots of rain on the way, Pat. And we still have snow up here, but I'm sure it's pretty melted out in Mills River, right?
There's one little patch which I'm going to go mine because we have a flat of hard to germinate herbs, things like Chinese skullcap and stuff, that want to have like a long, slow, cool soak. And so snow is a great thing to have on it. So I've been covering that flat with snow and I see one little patch and I hope it's still there when I get through. I have a phone call to do after this show and then I'm hoping I can still get one final load of snow on top of that flat. But that's the only snow I can see at the moment.
Oh yeah, it's all up and down the roads here too. It's melting, but it's everywhere up here. You get down in that valley, deep in that Broad River Valley, and it just sticks around some of those shady corners, but at least we know we don't have freezing temperatures for any more black ice right now.
Yeah, no, it's going to be warm for a while. And for us, this kind of rainy weather, we're doing some mushroom inoculating. We're going to be inoculating reishi, shiitake, and namiko, I think is what you call it. It's a new one that Greg Carter's recommending. And so we'll be spending some time in the greenhouse inoculating. It's kind of fun work. It's tedious, but we get many hands to make the time fly, And it's a good thing to do in this kind of weather because you really can't get in the soil much. And there's not a lot else to do besides ordering seeds, maybe starting some seedlings if you're planning on getting a real early start. But it's kind of a slow time on the farm otherwise.
Right, and here we are today at that cross-quarter point, Groundhog Day, that they refer to as in bulk, and moving, tipping towards spring now, just right on that edge.
Yep, we are indeed. We're at that place. It is supposedly the
Groundhog didn't see its shadows up there in Pennsylvania. Spring's supposed to come early. I'll take early spring, but we always have to roll with whatever we get.
Yeah, we've got a what we had a blizzard last night in Iowa, and we made it through our blizzard, and now it feels like spring is already here, and it's like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. But I know we'll have more. I'm sure we'll have more blizzards, or at least big snowstorms, or a few probably.
Well, we'll have cold, and if the cold comes when there's wet, we'll have snow. And since it's an El Nino year, that's pretty likely. I mean, I'm not counting on the snow being over for the season, that's for sure.
Yeah, I just worry sometimes, and maybe you have insight on this. I don't really know. I haven't studied into it, but I always wonder and sort of am concerned every time we get these really kind of long warm spells in the middle of winter and everything starts blooming. And it already happened once, right? Everything started. I saw red buds, I saw forsythia, all these things started blooming, and then they freeze, right, and die back, and then we get another warm spell now, and things will start almost blooming again. How many times can nature do that and still bloom when it really gets to be spring?
Well, they're using up buds, so it's not, I mean, they're not going to have as many blooms, And I know Jeremy was worried about that because a whole lot of the blueberries at his house were in bloom in December, And no, they're not going to, I mean, once a bud has bloomed, it's not going to bloom again. Now, there may be secondary buds right below that can come in and fill in the space, And it depends on each individual flower. Some plants, I think, probably are designed to seize the moment and take their chances, and they can take that. Other ones, it's like one shot. I have two different hollies, and the nursery I bought it from gave me a pollinating hollies are male and female, and so I wanted a China boy to pollinate my China girl. They didn't have one, and they looked in the book, and it didn't say that the one I had would work. But she says, "I know it does." And so they sold it to me, and it would work in a different place. But because I'm in CeeLo, where the weather's pretty capricious, we get a lot of lake hole and stuff, I end up having them blooming largely out of sync. They have about a week to 10 days overlap, and that's not enough. There aren't enough blooms left of the female flowers for the male flower to pollinate. One year, I had perfect timing, and I had a female flower covered with berries. And then, of course, we had a late cold and they all got killed. And so that's a situation of there aren't enough blooms for it to work at the right time. Even though there are lots of blooms, they're not quite enough. They don't keep going long enough. And that can happen with any number of other things, too.
Wow. So I was wondering, like, what if a plant uses up its blooms a lot and it could maybe squeeze out another set of blooms? It depends, I guess, on the fertility and how much.
I don't think it's fertility. I think it's got to do with its genetics, how many dormant buds it has, how many it can put
Right,
out,
dormant
and
buds, right.
yeah, exactly. I don't think fertility is, fertility, I mean, yeah, the healthier the plant in the first place, the more options it's going to have to reproduce. I mean, that's why plants are growing and exist, is to reproduce. That's the nature of life. And so, yeah, they're going to have, of whatever their mode is, whether they have a lot of dormant buds or not, if they have some dormant buds, they'll probably max those out if they have really good nutrition, If they don't have as much nutrition, I mean, there are years that plants didn't do well enough, they don't bother to try and reproduce at all, So, yeah, it's a continuum, and if they've been well taken care of, they probably are more likely to give you a bunch of buds, flowers when it's actually the right time. But it's got to do with genetics as much as anything else.
Right. So it's a good time to do some maybe inoculation if you have the spores. I know you mentioned, Greg Carter, Deepwoods Mushrooms, right? Deepwoods Mushrooms, that's somebody to grab those from. And then maybe getting started on some seedlings. Of course, attending workshops is great. We've got a couple coming up, 1 week just from today on February 9th, Cultivating Climate Resilience with Laura Langneck, author of Resilient Agriculture.
That should be pretty fascinating. This last storm was, one more shot across our bow as a civilization. It's not like we got this storm because of global warming, but everybody pretty much agrees the warmer ocean temperatures made for a bigger snowstorm. And interestingly now, finally, something I've mentioned a few times, I years ago saw it from a link from Aprita, one of the original biochar companies, to a BBC show. The thermohaline belt, what we call the Gulf Stream, is slowing down. And indeed, apparently it's been slowing down since 1930. Of course, we've had global warming for quite a while, not nearly as noticeable, but it's been slowing down since 1930. It has stopped numerous times in geologic time. It can stop in as little as 25 years. And the more it slows down, the more extreme weather will be, both here in the Southeast and particularly in Northern Europe. Northern Europe could be really, really reeling. I remember one of the predictions from that original article I read was ice storms with winds of 140,000 miles an hour. I mean, not I'm sorry, 140 miles an hour, not 1,000.
I was like, whoa. Well, no,
140,000 miles an hour, forget it. There goes the planet.
I'm like, wow.
That would create a vacuum, I think, that would suck everything behind it, too.
140 is fast enough. That's pretty fast. Yeah.
That's fast. Basically, that's essentially, one of the major hurricanes with ice. And of course, if you load all the infrastructure and trees above ground with ice and then hit them with that much wind, they're all coming down. So that prediction was like no electricity for England, And will that happen? We don't know. But we do know that what causes the Gulf Stream to slow down is less salty water. The cold doesn't drop as deep, and that's part of what it takes to get that thing, keep it flowing powerfully. And less salty water is a result of bigger rainstorms in the Northern Hemisphere and melting ice, as in Greenland. And between the storms in Siberia and all the water coming in from there into the North Atlantic and the melting ice, the water is not nearly as salty in the far north, and that can result in an increasingly slow and potentially eventually stopped Gulf Stream. And for us, that would probably mean less moderate temperature, too. Those Gulf waters moderate our coastal areas, and then our weather in general is affected by that. And so did we see a storm that was a result of only that? No. But was that a factor? According to the climate scientist, it was. And will it continue to be a factor? Yeah. And so for Laura to come and talk about this stuff, it's very real. We're seeing weather affected already by climate change, and those severe weather swings are only going to become greater swings. And so, we need to be thinking, how can we be most resilient? And I'd be interested to see how many fronts she's going to look at that on. There's, of course, a great array of ways to approach resilience. You can try to get more genetically diverse seed, grow greater varieties of plants, figure out season extension techniques to reduce the impact of big swings in weather. One of the things we're looking at here is to develop a network of ponds at our Grandview farm so that we are not reliant on groundwater. We have that very large infrastructure in the fancy greenhouse and in the biochar plant. Lots of roof area, and all of that has been plumbed to feed a pond. We have a large slope that comes to a steep bank right behind the biochar plant, and we're working with a permaculturist, John Nelson, and planting a berm right above there to let a lot of that water that would flow down and keep eroding that bank to soak back into the groundwater there, which might bring back a spring that has kind of died out a little further up on that hill. And then for the big rain events, we'll actually berm that and then do a swale that runs to a culvert, which will run the overflow into that pond. And we think it's quite possible that we can have enough water stored, and it's going to be a fairly large pond, in that pond that it would take more than a year of drought for us to have to even think about groundwater. And that, of course, is a way to be ready for the swings that we can have. We should all be looking at, are there ways that we can set up water systems that don't rely on groundwater? The danger of relying on groundwater is that it's basically fossil water. I mean, a lot of the big aquifers, water's been there forever, and it's not like you can replace it immediately. It takes, you know, serious time to recharge those aquifers. And so when they're drawn on by society, which we're doing everywhere, they go down and they go down and they come back very slowly. So it's a high value to look at ponds and other ways to irrigate and to conserve the water you have with mulching and with live mulches and stuff like that. So those are things that I know I'd be looking at. We'll see what Laura has to say about that. I'm looking forward to that workshop. It should be quite fascinating.
Right. I know we've had the zones of hardiness move a bit with the USDA official map. That's happened over the last few years. And then we have new information all the time and farmers trying to be resilient and adapting as much as they can. I know she's got insight there. But, you know, we get just one example of, like, for instance, the polar ice caps and all the various ice that remains in those polar regions. You know, we're now getting reports of the polar melting and the sea rising levels going 10 times faster than we were told. And so basically 10 times faster sea level rise, every coastal city is flooded at these rates, and it's 10 times faster than we were told. And so I'm looking at, you know, population moving too for our resilience at looking at food systems, because we look at coastal cities just nearby, you know, relatively. We've got all the northern cities and then down south, of course, Miami, Orlando, Tampa, all those areas down there in Florida, as well as New York and, you know, of course, Los Angeles and all
Wilmington, Charleston,
yeah.
Savannah. I mean, there's loads of plenty of significant metropolitan areas all along the East Coast. And yeah, will they be impacted by this? There is no question there will be impacts. I mean, they're already occurring. You know, there's already more flooding during storms and with combined high tides now than there have been in the past. And that's going to continue to happen. And will that impact people moving inland? Yeah, it will. Probably not in the next decade. But then again, who knows? Because as you say, all the predictions are continually having to be altered in the direction of the impact being greater and greater and faster because you have more and more tipping points. And every time a tipping point swings towards severe climate disturbance, then that tends to cause other ones. The classic example is the warming in the north causing the permafrost to thaw, causing the release of methane, which is way more of a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, which then wraps up the whole greenhouse effect cycle. And then, of course, likewise, the melting of the ice water affecting the Gulf Stream. There's going to be those continual effects, and one affects the other, and everything multiplies each other. So we will see an increase in that, you know, and it's important, very important for us to consider how to be resilient with that. And of course, also to just think, how can we as individuals, you know, reduce as much as possible our use of fossil fuels, pay attention. I mean, really, one thing that most anybody can do is let go of what I call recreational burning, you know, burning leaves in the fall, burning stuff just because it's kind of fun to get rid of stuff by burning it, you know. Get into the fact that, you know, the slow decay of stuff is much more what should be happening naturally. And yes, will some carbon dioxide be released if there's slow decay? Absolutely. But will that be nearly as intense as the impact of burning stuff poorly, which is what usually happens with this kind of burning? You know, people might, you know, be upset that I call it recreational burning, but it's because there are other options. You don't have to burn, you know. The odds are very good if it's leaves, you can find a neighbor that would die to get your leaves. You could probably pass those on to a neighboring gardener. Indeed, you probably list them on Craigslist and somebody probably come by and get them, you know. And excess brush and all that, that could be kindling for somebody else, you know. It's time for us to realize that we have to let go of some past behaviors that may have suited our ancestors but no longer make sense in the modern world.
Right, like throwing up cover crops instead of tilling. You know, the other day, Pat, it was so true what you're saying. I mean, give up that recreational burning for lots of reasons. You know, here in the mountains, a lot of people burn trash. And I was driving by there near the farm, and there's these people out there burning trash. And the acrid smell was so awful as I drove by. And I'm thinking they're standing right over this totally toxic cloud and they're poisoning themselves and the environment, you know? So yeah, it's time to move past that stuff and recycle. We have great recycling around here anyway.
Well, actually that one there, that could probably be solved by some legislation. I think what you saw there, and it's very common for people with not a lot of resources to go out and scavenge. And one of the things they can scavenge is old wire. And copper's worth quite a bit of money. It's worth way more if the insulation is removed. So the solution, the easy way to remove it is to burn it off, which of course is horrible. Yes, they have no idea what they're doing to themselves. They do not want to be breathing that stuff. But of course, it's also doing horrible things for the air. And quite simply, you know, there could simply be legislation that says that recyclers can no longer buy strip wire, you know,
right.
And that way there would be no incentive. They could, not only could they not pay more for it, they would have to take it, insulate it, and then they would recycle it someplace that's being regulated that would have to remove that insulation in a way that wasn't as toxic, you know. That's an easy solution, you know. And, yeah, it would somewhat reduce the value. They'd pay less for it. And I'm sorry for that because I understand that these people need money and that's why they're doing the recycling. But we're probably not going to convince them that it's not okay to burn that stuff off. And if we can't convince them of that, then quite simply making it so that the people who buy that stuff can no longer accept it clean, let alone pay money for it cleaned, and boom, we'll stop that one.
Right, right. Yeah, because people don't always look out for themselves. but it's
right.
Great to be moving through winter, at least. We made it through our first big snow. We've got lots of great workshops a whole year long coming up ahead. You can download a calendar there of everything coming up. Of course, the next one, I know we've got a full roster now, right? There's no more room in the charcuterie intensive and building a charcuterie cabinet with Meredith and Gred coming up February 13th. So that's all full, but you can still get in on the Cultivating Climate Resilience there with Laura Legnick, Resilient Agriculture. I've been meaning to read that book and talk more with her. It'd be great to hear her speak there on February 9th. So get registered at livingwebfarms.org.
And another one you can look at, by the way, that I recommend is, I mentioned it before on this show, The Tropic of Chaos, which is a book by Michael Parenti, talking about the impact of climate change on the tropical zones. That's really where the greatest impact is right now, and it's causing great chaos. That's why he's named the book Tropic of Chaos. It can be argued that the horrible disturbances in Syria got their start with drought. The awful... various terrible disturbances in the Middle East and in Northern Africa have been heavily influenced by drought. But why I'd actually recommend the book is for just a few mentions, and I've mentioned them before here, of positive things that are happening in places like Africa and Brazil, where they are developing systems of agriculture that are so interdependent, so diverse, such a mix of permaculture and annual agriculture and animal agriculture that they are developing incredible productivity and great resilience. Indeed, in certain places in Africa, they've seen an increase in the water table by as many as 9 feet because of these kinds of systems. And so those hopeful things, those are the pieces that I want us to know. It's not like, you know, we might sound like doom and gloom here in the past 10, 15 minutes as we talk about the impact of global climate change. But the reality is that we are not powerless. We can take action. We can take dynamic action, and that dynamic action can actually greatly reduce the impact, make us more resilient, and begin the process of repairing some of the damage we've done. So that's another book I recommend, and another way to look at these issues.
Certainly. Do you have any other things you'd like to share with us this week about getting our shoulders squared up for the new season and everything coming up ahead? Anything else you'd like to mention?
Well, you know, this is a time a lot of people might just ease off of gardening and go to other things. And, you know, that's a fine thing. I just went to the eye doctor yesterday. And he said, so do you have any hobbies, Mr. Battle? I was like, my hobby and my work are the same, you know. So I really can't separate them, you know. I'm always fascinated and wanting to be growing stuff. But, you know, if you're taking a break from this time now, that's fine. But remember that, you know, just a little bit of thought every week about what your plans are for the coming year. You know, you might think, oh, it's a nice, wonderful, warm day. I'm going to want to plant potatoes. I don't have any place ready. I've got a bunch of beds cover cropped. I'm going to get out there. I'm going to mow down maybe with my scythe. Maybe you went to our workshop, learned how to get a good scythe and work with a scythe, maybe with a weed eater, whatever. I'm going to mow some of this one bed that's cover cropped to the nubs, mulch it with leaves, you know. And then by sometime in March, I'm going to be able to plant in there, you know. So that kind of just, you know, don't check out completely from the garden. This may very well be a fine time to be thinking about, instead of what you're going to do to the garden, is what kind of Valentine you're going to make your sweetie. I mean, I get that. That's fine, you know. We don't have to be fully focused on gardening year-round. Indeed, a little bit of a break once in a while might be fine. But remember that a little bit of thought each week and a few actions might well set you up to make this your best year ever. And just do that kind of thinking about it and just kind of sinking back into it and thinking, what do I want to be doing in the garden, even if it's not my main focus this time of year?
Hey, Pat, the other day, I'll just share real quickly, I had a little garden in the house experience. Nature came here. I'm sitting here talking to my mom, and I hear, and I'm like, what in the world? I'm turning around, and my kitty has a mole. She has a mole right in her mouth, right in the living room, running in here, so proud. And I'm like, oh, give me that. She's running off with this thing, going all the way in the kitchen, running in circles because she doesn't want me to take her toy. You know, and finally she dropped it for me. Then it ran down the hall. Then it fell down the stairs. Then, okay, 30 minutes later, we found the mole. And I took this. It was so slippery. I could not catch it. It was slipping right out of my hand. It was slipping. Mm-hmm. And brought it out to the garden. I thought, okay, I'll put it under the row cover. I'll be so happy. I bring it right to the edge of the row cover because under there it's all warm with lots of bugs, mm-hmm. you know. And that little mole was so happy. His little face went up. His little nose wiggled around. And he took off under there. He was so happy. And, of course, I can't do any gardening out there really, right? I managed to get all those daikons pickled. I got the Korean daikon radishes going there in the ferment. And I just want more flowers. So I've got that sprout water. I've discovered the sprout water going from sprouting alfalfa, broccoli, and fenugreek. And then I water the plants, and they flower like crazy. So I'm over here inducing flowers again.
Uh-huh.
With
uh-huh,
sprout
yeah.
water.
Yep. That makes complete sense. Yeah, that's something else, you know, something that people can do this time of year. I've got some pussy willows starting to happen. You can look at the swelling buds on various flowering things, and you can bring them inside and force them. You know, you put them overnight in quite warm water, you know, 80 degree or something like that. Take them out and then set them up. Blooms well ahead of time. And that's a way to maybe bring spring a little bit more quickly to you.
Well, it sounds great. Otherwise, we'll just enjoy the deepening root time of winter. It's always great eating those nice old winter squashes from fall and making the hearty soups and whatnot. So hope you have a wonderful week, and we'll talk to you really
Thanks.
Soon then.
All right. Okay. Catch you next week. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. That is Patrick Battle, This Week in the Garden, and he always gets to tell us every week what to do and how to do it, maybe ideas, inspirations, things to remember, little things he's learned over the years that it might take us years to learn, but instead we get to glean that knowledge right here on Earth Heart Network Radio. Glad to have Patrick Battle there, and we look forward to talking to him next week, 1 week from today. A reminder on February 9th, Cultivating Climate Resilience, the author of Resilient Agriculture, Laura Lengnick, there at Living Web Farms. We're going to be at the Mills River Educational Farm. Register now online at livingwebfarms.org. We'll talk to you soon on Earth Heart Network Radio.